Welcome to Torah Macha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Tzivi Zuckerman, and today we will be studying Malachim Bet, Perek Tet Zayin, Chapter 16. If any of you have teenagers or have interacted with teenagers, you know that teens value their independence, possibly above all else. This is appropriate for their developmental stage, their learning who they are and who they want to become. However, you probably also know that the development of independence that doesn't have appropriate guidance and limits can develop in a way that is totally self-serving, and it can morph into full-blown defiance. Let's examine how this same trend expresses itself in the monarchy of Malchut Yehuda. This parak is about Achaz, the son of Yotam Melech Yehuda, a king who sets an unprecedented low for Malchut Yehuda, introducing a new level of idolatry and depravity into the land. Pasuk Bet, verse 2, introduces Achaz as a king, saying, Lo asah yashar b'enei Hashem elokav k'David aviv. He did not do what was pleasing to Hashem his God, as his ancestor David had done. What is interesting is that the verse does not say asah ra b'enei Hashem. It doesn't seem to write him off as evil immediately, instead using softer language, saying he did not do good like David. Perhaps he started off as a benign king. However, the subsequent psukim go on to detail a long list of the evil that he perpetrated, so regardless of the way he started off, it's clear that very soon Achaz was involved in some of the worst idolatrous practices known to the ancient world. Achaz establishes the Baal cult throughout Yehuda, along with a variety of other idolatrous practices. Although Ataliah had introduced the Baal briefly into Yehuda, it had been destroyed by the people after the assassination of Ataliah. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, relates that Achaz worshipped Molech, an ancient Canaanite pagan rite, where the worshipper's child was either passed between two fires, or, according to the Ramban, and supported by the language of the verses in Devar HaYamim, the child is actually burned in the fire. According to the latter opinion, that Molech is a rite of child sacrifice, this begs the question of how the Davidic succession survived a king who worshipped Molech. Rashi on the Gemara in Sanhedrin 63b explains that Chizkiyahu, Achaz's only son and the next king of Yehuda, was in fact offered in the Molech ceremony, as the verse states. However, his mother applied a fire retardant to his body before the ritual was performed, which succeeded in saving his life. Pasuk Dalet, verse 4, adds, "Ve'zabeach ve'yekater ba'bamot ve'al hagva'ot ve'tachat kol etz ra'anan." He sacrificed and made offerings at the bamot, the shrines, on the hills, and under every leafy tree. It's clear from the context in this verse that the bamot here were being used for Avodah Zarah. Now, with the previous number of kings, we saw that despite the positive assessment given to them in the text, the one caveat mentioned with each one is the continued use of the bamot by the people, these personal altars that were used for sacrifices to God, which, once the Beit HaMikdash was built by Shlomo, were no longer allowed. Perhaps the idea of the bamot reflects the theme that we have been discussing. The retention of the bamot on the part of the people indicates a form of avodas Hashem where the worshipper prioritizes his own convenience and preferences over God's will. He's saying, essentially, I know that God said that now we need to travel to the Beit HaMikdash to offer karbanot, but I've always offered sacrifices on these local altars, and really, my convenience is the way I worship God is going to remain my priority. This is strikingly similar to Uzziah's attempt to bring Keturah, an attempt to worship God in the way that reflected his own desires rather than those of God. It's not a very long distance conceptually from a self-absorbed style in the worship of God on the bamot to the use of the bamot for Avodah Zarah. Perhaps the bamot symbolize this trend that we've been examining with the last few kings. On the surface, it seems surprising that Yotam, an enormously righteous person who was exceedingly humble, would have a son as evil as Achaz. However, if we think about what we know about the development of the kingship since its renewal with Yehoash, we'll remember that there were issues bubbling beneath the surface. As we explained previously, although Yehoash, Amatzia, and Uzziah are all described as good kings in Malachim, each of them struggles with the challenge of Kochi Ba'otzim Yadi, the myth of independence, and Kfiat HaTov, the need to invert reality and assert that I don't owe anything to anyone. We saw this with Yehoash allowing his servants to deify him and his consequent Kafoy Tov in killing his mentor Yehoyada's son, Zechariah. We also saw this with Amatzia in his importation of Edomite idols in an attempt to mask his indebtedness to Hashem. This sense of outsized independence expresses itself in Uzziah as well. When in bringing Keturah as a non-Kohen, he serves Hashem in the manner of his own choosing, irrespective of Hashem's wishes. Although Yotam was a completely righteous king, he's not successful in turning back this tide of self-absorption. During the reigns of these kings, this conflict exists under the surface as a sort of undercurrent of tension. During the reign of Ahaz, these latent issues, this pull toward an inappropriate and inaccurate statement of independence, blooms into a full-fledged rebellion against God. This selfishness further expresses itself in a degeneration of the wider Jewish society, decried by all of the Nevi'im of the time, with a prevalence of deceit, corruption, and exploitation. Immediately after the description of Ahaz's evil behavior, Schar Va'onesh goes into action. Pasuk Hey, verse 5 begins, Az Ya'aleh Ritzin Melech Aram Upechach Ben Ramaliyahu Melech Yisrael Yerushalayim LaMelchama. Then King Ritzin of Aram and King Pekach Ben Ramaliyah of Yisrael advance on Yerushalayim for battle. The word Az is generally used to indicate cause and effect. As a result of the previously mentioned idolatry of Ahaz, he is threatened by this alliance of Aram and Melech Yisrael, who joined forces in an attempt to stave off the growing regional threat of Assyrian expansionism. Aram and Melech Yisrael mount a joint expedition to try to install a puppet king in Melech Yehuda, who will support their anti-Assyrian alliance. Ahaz goes into a panic in the face of this threat, and as related in Perek Zion, chapter 7 of Sefer Yeshaya, the Navi Yeshaya assures Ahaz that he does not need to be concerned about the threat because Hashem will save him. Yeshaya even presses Ahaz to ask Hashem for a sign that the nevuah about his salvation will come true. However, Ahaz responds cynically, according to Rashi, refusing to ask God for a sign since he has no interest in facilitating the Kiddush Hashem that would ensue if he did so. Instead of relying on Yeshaya's nevuah and the promise of God's salvation, Ahaz decides to surrender his independence to Ashur, entering into a vassal agreement of protection in exchange for tribute. Ashur is only too glad to accept. Ahaz's entreaty to the king of Ashur is degrading to an embarrassing degree, where he says to the Assyrian king in Pasuk Zion, verse 7, Avdecha uvincha ani, I am your servant and your son. Yeshaya warns Ahaz in chapter 8 of Yeshaya that inviting Ashur into Eretz Yisrael as an ally is a foolish move that could easily backfire from a practical standpoint, with Ashur turning against Malchut Yehuda as an enemy. By inviting the Assyrians into Israel, Ahaz opened the path to the Galut Aseret HaShvatim, the exile of the 10 tribes, and Ashur later attacks Yehuda as well. Yeshaya recognizes that inviting the Assyrians into the affairs of the Jewish people is deeply problematic spiritually as well, for two reasons. Firstly, Ahaz makes it clear that he's not willing to rely on God, which is a clear lack of bitachon. Paradoxically, Ahaz's military alliance with Ashur will only make the Jewish people more vulnerable to Assyrian aggression, since the lack of bitachon will make them more susceptible to attack, not less so. The Assyrian threat against Malchut Yehuda will materialize during the reign of Ahaz's son Chizkiyahu, with a prolonged and threatening siege after the Assyrians had already conquered and exiled the northern tribes. However, the second spiritual concern about an alliance with Ashur is more immediate. Welcoming a powerful and idolatrous ally into the affairs of Malchut Yehuda carries with it the threat of cultural assimilation. In fact, the religious and cultural influence of Ashur and Malchut Yehuda are quick in coming. In Psukim Yud through Tezayin, verses 10 through 16, Ahaz voluntarily imitates Assyrian culture and worship. He goes as far as importing a replica of an Assyrian altar into the Beit HaMikdash, displacing the Mizbeach of Shlomo HaMelech. As described in Pasuk Yedayin, verse 17, Ahaz also dismantles many of the vessels and structures in the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash. The Maharal, based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin 103b, explains that Ahaz's evil deeds, among them the above-mentioned desecration of the Beit HaMikdash, were part of a comprehensive plan whose goal was the removal of the Shekhinah, God's presence, from Israel. Ahaz's plan focused on three main areas. Firstly, Ahaz had a particular vendetta against Limud Torah, Torah study. The Talmud Yerushalmi in Sanhedrin 10:2 explains that Ahaz dismantled the educational system in Malchut Yehuda. In fact, the Talmud states that he is called Achaz, which means to grab, since he grabbed the shuls and the Bate Midrash, the study halls, to shut them down. His goal was to try to prevent the education and cultivation of prophets and prophecy. If there were no longer any prophets, he surmised, he could succeed in his goal of preventing God's presence from resting in Israel. Secondly, the Talmud in Sanhedrin explains, as we have described already, Achaz eliminated the avoda, the temple service, in the Beit HaMikdash, the prime vehicle for bringing God's presence into the midst of the Jewish people. Most specifically, according to the Medrash Tanhuma, he eliminated the ketoret, the offering which symbolizes one of the highest expressions of the Jewish people's close bond with God. Lastly, Achaz legitimized forbidden and incestuous relationships, since appropriate marriage relationships, defined by the deep bonding and focused giving that are only possible with commitment and exclusivity, are a primary vehicle for the resting of God's presence in Israel. What had begun as an aversion to dependence on the part of earlier kings had morphed with Achaz into a determined campaign to eliminate the people's ability to connect with God and draw his presence into their midst. This campaign is deliberately and fundamentally counter to the mission of the Jewish people. It serves as the root of what later becomes an even larger scale rebellion in the times of Menashe, Achaz's grandson, who takes Achaz's behavior even further, if that can be imagined. The sages in the Talmud debate whether Achaz lost his share in Olam Haba, the world to come. The opinion that he did not lose his share in the world to come is based on the opinion of Rav Yosef in the Gemara in Sanhedrin 104a. When Yeshaya came to rebuke him, Achaz hid from him, indicating that he had boshet panim, he was ashamed of his evil behavior. This quality of busha, of embarrassment in the face of wrongdoing, is one of the essential qualities of the Jewish nation, who are called rachmanim, baishanim, and gomli chasadim, compassionate, bashful, and kind. Perhaps the reason embarrassment, where appropriate, is so essential is that embarrassment of wrongdoing indicates the existence of a moral compass, however weak, as in Achaz's case, making space for hope and change. My mother has told me many times of a wise woman she knew who used to say, "Guilt is not a Jewish emotion." Although classically Jewish mother's guilt is a strong feature in Jewish culture, a reaction that is perhaps healthier and more appropriate is regret for our mistakes. Mistakes don't make us evil, and we don't need to eat ourselves up with guilt over them. What we do need to do is acknowledge our mistakes, feel the embarrassment that comes from knowing that we can do better, and move forward toward change in a positive way. Our goal in the face of failure is regret that leads to hope and change. Thank you for studying together. Le'iloi Nishmas Frida, Bat Moshe Eliyahu.